Okay, before we begin.
Wow, there's a lot of people in here.
That's great.
How fun.
Good thing I didn't plan on 10 handouts. That would have been embarrassing. All right, the question is, how many of you celebrated yesterday? You know what yesterday was?
Pi Day.
It was Pi Day. It's also St. Patrick's Day, but that's...
No.
That's too... Anyway. Happy Pi Day. Do you know why it was such an epic day? Anybody? Okay.
1.14159265391.
Okay, we got someone who actually has it memorized.
What?
She was the math.
Okay, this is pi, right?
Yeah.
1.159.
That's also pi.
265.
And so yesterday was March 14, 2015. And at 9...
265359.
9:26 with 53 seconds was yesterday.
Really?
So we have the first, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 digits of pi happened twice yesterday, will not happen again for 100 years. Isn't that fun? Lisa and I ate a piece of pie at that second.
Apparently, students that applied to MIT were supposed to log in at that time to see if they...
They were supposed to log in at that time if you applied to MIT to see if they got it. I love it. Anyway. Isn't God amazing? I mean, just think about this precision. The state of Indiana in the 1800s tried to vote to round this to 3.2 or 3.1. And everyone went, "What? You can't do that," you know?
There's an infinite number of digits.
I have a link on my blog to the website that has the first 1 million digits of pi.
And that still doesn't round.
And it's an infinite number. Anyway, so you're dismissed.
It's our joy. Now, last week we were talking about the mustard seed and all of that, or actually it was 2 weeks ago. And you had told me that you had a mustard seed encased in a little necklace. So when we handed it...
From the 1950s?
From the 1950s? Do you want to hand it around?
Even though...
So if it doesn't return to the front of the room, we will... We'll be patting you down in the sanctuary. Oh, you brought one too? All right, that's great. So hand it around.
Get passed over there.
Yeah, that one will be passed this side, that'll be passed that side if you want to look what a mustard seed is. Because the idea is how small it was and in the parable.
John thinks that somehow is enlarged, you know, that it's magnified.
Oh.
That's fairly large.
Because that particular one, if you look at it, it looks larger than it is because it's in a case kind of like in a little magnifying glass. All right. Please turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 13. And we will continue our study. We're trying, for those of you who aren't in our class normally, we're trying to work our way through the Bible chronologically. And we have run into these series of parables that Jesus was speaking in Matthew chapter 13. We've already done the sower and the seed. We've done the parable of the weeds. And this week, we are starting at verse 44. So we have verse 44 and following, where they seem very simple. And our methodology or our attempt in our study here is to try to take the very incredibly familiar pieces of Scripture that we have all heard before. We have probably memorized them or taught them in classes, taught them in Sunday school, and kind of pick it up, turn it around, flip it upside down, examine it in a way that we don't normally do. You probably won't hear this kind of exposition even in a sermon because I go off on rabbit trails that and sermons typically don't, although Tim does like to get off on his rabbit trails, but that's a part of his style. But you understand what I mean? Is it's our opportunity to really dig and look behind what's going on and also look at some of the controversies that have arisen out of this. So fairly simple. We have the first two that I want to look at today. Verse 44, the kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and covered up. Then in his joy, he goes and sells all he has and buys that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who, on finding one pearl of great value, went and sold all he had and bought it. Now, on the surface, that looks fairly straightforward and simple, and we might be able to last 10 minutes in this study and then move on to something different. A couple things you need to look at. First is, and I guess it would be a question for you, to whom is Jesus speaking? Who's he talking to in this passage? The answer is in verse 36, above. He had been speaking in parables to a large crowd, and then he left the crowds and went into the house. And then his disciples came to him and said, explain to us the parable of the weeds in the field. And he does. And then he comes to what we have here in verse 44. So the audience is not the general populace. The audience are his disciples, those who would understand a little bit more maybe than your, you know, general seeker, general person who's curious. It's also probably one of the reasons why you don't have this parable interpreted. It's just stated. The treasure is hidden in a field. Hidden suggests what?
Buried
on purpose. This isn't an accident. It isn't like Jed Clampett, you know, who was shooting at some coon and up from the ground came a bubbling crude oil, that is, Texas tea. Yeah. First thing you know, old Jed's a millionaire. Anybody know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, thank you.
I have a few nods. Yes, the immortal, the classic, the Beverly Hillbillies. But that was an accident, and it was already there. This was a treasure that was buried. And someone said, well, you know, who's going to bury their treasure in their backyard? Well, everybody. They didn't have banks. And you think about the war-ravaged nature of Palestine and Israel, the traveling hordes of armies and raiders and thieves or whatever would come roaring through a town and tear it up. And, you know, if you're going to keep something, you would bury it. And what happened, apparently, fairly often, it would get buried, and that person might pass away. They might have been killed in the battles or whatever, and that treasure still sits there. Now, this isn't a perfect example, but it flashed in my mind sometime in the last 2 or 3 months, there was an incident of a discovery of a Western carbine rifle that was discovered just sitting in a tree out in the middle of the desert. Anybody read the article? Yeah, and it had been sitting there probably, 100 years? And no one had ever seen it. Because some cowboy, some Western roaming guy had leaned it against a tree, probably was drunk, walked off and couldn't find his rifle. Couldn't find out which tree he stuck it next to. And the way the shading was, and as the wood in the stock aged, it began to blend in, was perfectly camouflaged against the tree. And no one saw it until some guy stumbled over it in the desert and went, wait a minute, this is an antique. What's it doing here? And you think, all right, well, we have our own mythology out in the southeastern part of the valley, the lost Dutchman mine. You know, there's that idea that someday somebody's going to find it. Well, I haven't found it yet. Makes for a great myth. But then someone came up with this thought. The man in this story is dishonest. Think about that for a second. He found something that wasn't his. So he reburies it. Then he goes out and buys the land so it can become his. Because here's the law. The law, especially in the Jewish law, is that if you buy a bag of corn and you find in the bag coins, they're yours. Because you bought the receptacle in which the coins were found. But if the coins are on the ground, they're not yours unless you own the ground that they have fallen on. So if they're in a public street, they are part of the city. The city would own it, or the town would own it. If it was on someone's front porch, the owner of the house owns that coin, so you must either give it to them or buy the house. Isn't that interesting? So in that sense, it's not deceptive. And you know, as you guys know, I do an awful lot of reading in preparation for this, and I came across some of the most outrageous comments and outrageous statements. They begin, so often these commentators and scholars, I guess in an effort to keep their job at their university, come up with some of the wildest themes and wildest ideas, and they end up missing the point because they're focusing on whether or not this guy's lying or not. That's not the point. If that were the point, if the point of this parable with ethics, Jesus would have made it very clear. This is a parable about ethics. In fact, in any other parable where ethics are a central theme, Jesus makes a point of applying the ethical portion of that behavior to the parable. It's part of the story. Obviously, that's not what's meant here. Now, it says it's a treasure. I'm going to ask you, if you can tell me, how do we define treasure? How do you define treasure? What are ways we... How do you know it's valuable?
Very subjective.
So it's subjective, but there is objective criteria that I think all of us will use. What?
eBay.
Okay. I'll give you that one. And why? Because it's an outside authority. Someone tells you this is valuable. Now, for example, if you collect, little statues,
little Hummels.
Hummels, all right. You don't know how much it's worth. You have a bunch of them that you inherited from your aunt, and you think they're worth $50, but try to sell them on eBay for more than 20. And an outside criteria tells you whether or not it's a treasure, right? That's a kind of a weak example, but there's one example. Another would be, in fact, you dealt with cars, collectibles, right? You sold one of your collectible cars recently. How did you know how much to sell it for?
Comparables.
An outside authority to others that of similar nature, all right? And so when you went to put it up for auction, you had a general idea how much that was going to sell for and whether someone was bargain hunting with you, right?
You bet.
Yeah. You're hoping someone would be stupid and overpay, but that's
no,
another...
No, they'd be smart.
They would be smart.
They know the value.
There you go. All right. Yeah?
Well, mine's just, you can finish with his, but I think, remember I said my little thing was a treasure when you said if it doesn't come around. But that's because I value it because of memory.
Right.
It's my own personal value.
Right.
Although, if you look on eBay, you will see that now you could buy a retro one for probably $25, and my guess is it cost $1 back in the 50s. But my grandfather gave it to me, who brought me to the Lord. And you know, so to me, it's a personal
treasure. It has intrinsic value to you. That would be different from someone else who would find it in a pawn shop and go, I'll give you 5 cents for it.
Exactly.
Does
to you would say, I've not given this, it's priceless to me.
Right, I knew I still had it at home, if I could just find it. But it wasn't hard.
Another thing that creates treasure is that it's rare.
It's rarity.
It's rarity. It's hard to find. I've only seen replays of the show, but the Antique Roadshow.
Oh, yes.
You know, someone will bring in what they think is a treasure, and they'll look at it and go, well, that's a fake. Oh, what? I thought it was really worth something. A favorite recently was this woman that her grandmother ran a boarding house in turn of the century, and the baseball players would stay there during their spring training, and had letters signed from Shoeless Joe Jackson, and had original baseball cards from back there that her grandmother had kept, and then created kind of a little display case for them. And so this lady walks in and says, oh, you know, I don't know if this is worth anything. And of course the evaluator's like, oh, you realize this is worth $100,000? And it's like, what? I had no idea. Well, she's not going to sell it now. But she was thinking of possibly getting rid of it.
Yeah, I saw one just the other day where this lady had a bracelet and some other things that her husband, the editor, says, don't sell this. When I die, you can sell it. And each bead, you go back to Ben-Hur, and where they want to validate the document, you know, they have a signet ring and they put it on. The beads were the jewels that was part of the signet ring. And she had a whole series that was worth $500,000.
Wow.
She had no idea.
Had no idea.
Wow.
Durability. You don't treasure skywriting.
Just
for a second, you appreciate it, but then it's gone. It just blows away. There's no value to it. Sidewalk art. As an artist, if you did chalk drawing on the sidewalk and you tried to sell it, they would look at you and go, sorry, you can pay to look. That's about it. I mean, you can't take it home with you. There's this element of, what is that treasure? So while we think about this, imagine yourself in the position of this person who's in the field. Is he plowing the field? Is he renting the land? Is he just strolling along and, you know, trips over a lump in the ground and pulls it away and finds a little chest of something or other? We don't know. But it's his reaction that says it's this. Because he goes and sells everything he has to buy that field so he can own that treasure. There's something in this treasure that makes it extraordinary. Now, the suggestion is that it's an accidental discovery. He didn't go looking for it, because we find the pursuit of the treasure in the next parable, not in this one. So there's a suggestion that it's accidental. Now, in interpreting a parable like this, and in realizing when Jesus is saying that the parable is about the kingdom of heaven, gives it a spiritual overtone, spiritual meaning, which then suggests that we're talking about the gospel of Jesus Christ, the great treasure that is found. So, again, many of the commentators and all that say, you have to start looking here at how the gospel meets people. Some people search and search and search, and then they find Jesus. Others, like Paul, go running the other direction, fight against it, kill it, and then they run into it suddenly, and it's a wake-up call. So, John MacArthur, in his commentary on this, begins, he relays the story of the conversion of Charles Spurgeon. So I thought I'd read that for you. It's very brief. Spurgeon grew up in a Christian home. But as a boy, he attended church only because it was the proper thing to do. He was not immoral or rebellious. He was satisfied with life and not looking to seek any more religion than he already had. One New Year's morning, I thought, wait a minute. One New Year's morning, January 1st. What are you doing on January 1st? In the morning. You're sleeping. You're not going to church. I'm sorry. So he's already kind of a religious kid. But anyway, just, and the fact that there's a service. Try to find a New Year's Day church service in America. Unless it happens to be on Sunday. It's just not going to happen. I just thought that was interesting. But that was a rabbit trail. Sorry. So one New Year's morning when he was 15 years old. Stop again, rabbit trail. When I was 15, I'm sorry. Last thing I wanted to do was get up early any day, much less on a holiday like that. And when I was at age 15, I was living in Honolulu, and the New Year's Eve celebration, the city of Honolulu also allowed it to be celebrated as a Chinese New Year, which meant fireworks were used. And the fireworks, the firecrackers are so loud. Have you, anybody ever been in Honolulu on New Year's Eve? Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. It's a roar for hours. The taxi cabs will not drive in downtown Honolulu because it's so dangerous. People are throwing firecrackers off the balconies, and with the next morning, the city workers come through with bulldozers and shovels for the red paper that's covering the ground, and it's just part of the celebration. So you don't sleep much the night before. Anyway, rabbit trail. That's two. I'm allowed three.
No.
And he's 15 years old. He decided he ought to attend the service at his church. The snow and the cold wind were too fierce for him, so he ducked into a little storefront type of church, as much to get out of the cold as anything. He writes, "When I could go no further, I turned down a court and came to a little primitive Methodist church. The preacher, who was to have conducted the service, could not get there because of the weather. So one of the men had to be brought forward to conduct the service with a congregation of about 15 people. This man was really stupid." Spurgeon's words. That's a nice thing to say. His text was, "Look unto me and be saved, all the ends of the earth." But all he did was keep repeating that phrase because he had nothing else to say. "Look unto me and be saved, all the ends of the earth." But something about Spurgeon caught the man's eye. And he pointed at Spurgeon and said, "Young man, you look miserable. And miserable in life and miserable in death you will be if you don't obey this text." And he shouted, "Young man, look to Jesus. Look. Look." "So I looked," said Spurgeon. "And then and there the cloud was gone, the darkness rolled away, and in that moment I saw the Son of God." Wow. Accidental. Weather turned him into a little storefront. Imagine you're driving by some or walking by some storefront here, and there happens to be a church there, and you stumble in, and then there's this odd person up there who then shouts at you. Normally your reaction is to say, "Go away, leave me alone," but instead God used that moment and woke up the spirit inside of Spurgeon, and we have the Charles Spurgeon of the day. So you can almost see what the point being here is, that there are times where there is that accidental meeting of Christ, meeting of the spiritual thing, and you then will do anything you can to keep it. It's also interesting to say that he sold all he had so they could buy the field. He was not a bargain hunter. He wasn't trying to undervalue the property. He went to pay the price that was necessary to buy that piece of property. I mean, there are many stories. I came across another one about a rock collector who was at a rock show, and there was a bunch of agates. And then in the middle of that, in a Tupperware tin, or not tin, but Tupperware container, was a potato-sized rock. And the rock collector looked at that and went, huh, that's different. Picks up and says to the vendor, so how much? And the guy points at a sign, any stone, $15. And he looks at it and goes, oh. And he said, the guy looks at it, you're going to have that one for 10. That one's just really ugly. It's not like all the other agates that are around it. And so he paid $10. That rock was a star, the largest star sapphire in the world. That when cut was worth $10 million. And he bought it for 10. And you think, oh, you know, he ripped the guy off. No, it was a fair exchange. The guy had no idea what the value was. He was happy with his $10. I like old books and just, you know, that's my world is publishing and all of that. And was at this was a couple few years ago, and the front of the library, there are books that have been donated or whatever, and they don't want them. So they stick them out for 10 cents or 25 cents, and you just go kind of looking through the hardbacks and went, wait a minute. That's a Ray Bradbury science fiction author. Hardcover, you don't see very many of those. So I pulled it off, pristine condition, first edition. No markings in it, not even a 25 cent pencil mark on the front. And I'm thinking, they want 25 cents for this? They know what this is? No, they don't. I bought it. I sold it on eBay for $70. And I could have kept it, but I didn't really want it. The man who bought it sent me an email saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. This allowed me to complete my collection of Ray Bradbury hardcover first editions, and I've been looking for this one for 15 years. I was like, okay, that felt pretty good. All right.
You only get 70 bucks for it.
Only 70. Yeah. I should have said 150 according to you. Yeah. Anyway. So this whole thing about the treasure and these various stories, I think we got the kind of the picture. Now let's contrast it with the next parable, which is the parable of great price. This is very famous. Anybody know the title of a book called The Pearl of Great Price? It's the second most important book at the Mormon Church. You know, the Book of Mormon and their book, The Pearl of Great Price. That's what it's named after. It says, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant. Very important, I should say it's that important, but it's interesting. I'll put it that way. The word for merchant there is the Greek word emporos, from which we get our word emporium. It also suggests that an emporos is a wholesaler who goes out and finds goods at reasonable prices and then resells them to the retailer, which in 2 Corinthians we find the retailer named with the Greek word kapalos, which means peddler. So you have the wholesaler and the retailer. We have economy. Economics 101 is in the New Testament, whether you like it or not. It's there. We have the wholesaler selling to the retailer, the traveling merchant selling to the peddler. It happens. It's out there. So we have this emporos, this wholesaler, in search of fine pearls. He's looking for them, which means he's an expert. When we had our thing, he would be one of the evaluators. He would know the value of the pearl. Now, before I go too much further, what are a couple other uses of the pearl in the New Testament that you can think of right offhand? Do not cast
them to the pigs.
Do not cast your pearls before swine. Okay, what's the big deal? They're just pearls. What about Revelation chapter 21? What are the gates made out of? Pearly gates. And it says they are one carved pearl. You have to stop for a second. How big is that pearl? Oh my goodness sake. I mean, if we were in the book of Revelation, I would stop here for a moment and say, a pearl, if it's a big as a, you know, the massive marbles, you don't find those. Okay, they just don't. That would be an awful big oyster. But imagine one big enough to be carved into a gate. That's one honking oyster. Okay, that's a pretty big oyster. Now, the concept of pearls, it's very intriguing if you look in the Old Testament. You only find the word pearl mentioned twice in the entire Old Testament. Once in the first chapter of Esther, where it's describing the palace that she's a part of, and there is mother of pearl in the floor. The other portion is in the book of Job. Job chapter 28, where Job is searching for wisdom. I'm going to find it here. I do have it marked. There we go. And Job starts to describe the mining process for fine things like gold and silver. He says, surely there's a mine for silver and a place for gold. Man puts an end to darkness and searches out the farthest limit, the ore in gloom and deep darkness. He's describing gold mines and silver mines. He opens shafts in the valleys away from where anyone lives, where they're forgotten by travelers. Its stones are the place of sapphires. Its dust is of gold. A path that no bird of prey knows, and the falcon's eye cannot see it. It's hidden away. You don't see those treasures that are under the ground. He cuts channels in the rocks, and his eye sees every precious thing. He dams up the streams so they do not trickle, and that the thing that is hidden is brought out to light. And if you ever go up to Alaska and do the gold panning or all of that, they dam up the river and then they dig out the sluice, throw it into the thing, and they sift through and try to find the little flecks of gold at the bottom of the stream. It's all a human process to sift out what is treasured. And then Job writes, but where will wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its worth, and it's not found in the land of the living. Gold and glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewels or fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or crystal. The price of wisdom is above pearls. Those are the only two places where pearls are mentioned in the Old Testament. Why? They had not been discovered by the West. They were discovered by Persia. That's why Esther is mentioned, because she was dealing with Babylon, Iraq, Iran, whatever we want to call it now. India, the Persian Gulf was where pearls were first discovered in the oceans, that they would open those oysters and find these little white things, very rare, very hard to find. You may have seen documentaries or whatnot of the pearl divers who learn how to hold their breath for up to 3 minutes. They don't use scuba gear, they just dive, and they're down there harvesting the pearls, and they have them actually laid out in farms so they know which ones are ripe and which ones are not. How do you know a pearl is ripe? I don't know, but that's another story. Pearls were discovered by the West, by Alexander the Great, when he conquered Persia. He comes into Persia and goes, look at these things. These are amazing. Where did they come from? And began the human pursuit of pearls throughout the world, the Western world, and the world we know it today. In 61 BC, Pompey's triumphal procession into Rome after one of his grand victories had 33 crowns that were made of pearls that were part of the procession. Julius Caesar, 6 years later, invaded Great Britain, took it over. A lot of people are going, why did he ever go there? Kind of like invading Russia for Napoleon. You know, it just was just too far. Extended the empire too far. One of the theories is that there are pearl deposits in Scotland, where you can, now the most of them have been farmed out now, but you don't find it as often, but there was a pearl bed in the Scotland waters. Julius Caesar gave Brutus's mother a pearl that in today's money was worth $100,000. No wonder he was upset when Brutus killed him. Wait a minute, I treated your mom right. No, that wasn't, no, Shakespeare didn't write that one. Cleopatra, we've all heard of her. Looks just like Elizabeth Taylor. Amazing thing, I don't know how that happened. It's kind of incredible. Cleopatra, she was married to Julius Caesar, whether you remember that, for a brief time. He actually had a son named Caesarea, where we get the word Caesarian from. After he died, she later married who? Anybody remember? Mark Antony. And they lived large and whatnot. Well, Pliny the Elder has this entire story about how Mark Antony and Cleopatra were kind of trying to one-up each other and how wealthy they were, even while they're married. I mean, it was just extravagant. It was also known at the time that Cleopatra owned the two largest pearls in the world that were known at that time. It gave a value to them, and it's a word, S-E-S-T-E-R-C-E-S, sesterces, which I guess was their coin, was worth, each one was worth 30 million sesterces. We figure today's money, that might have been $1.5 million a pearl. Pliny the Elder says, where is it? This is the quote. Antony joked with her and inquired what was the amount that she had spent on it, to which she made an answer that the banquet that he beheld was only a trifling of the real banquet, and that she alone would consume the meal to the ascertained amount of value of that amount. So she dissolved one of the pearls into a glass and drank it. So, you have something worth $1.5 million and you feel like you just want to burn it? Just drop it in some, and she drank one of the most valuable pearls in the known world. Now people have said, oh, that's completely false. There's no way. So these scientists got involved recently and they tried to replicate this. How could you have any kind of liquid that would dissolve a pearl that wouldn't kill you when you drank it? And that would be kind of an important thing. So they began to study Cleopatra, study that time. Did you know she wrote a book about cosmetics? Yeah, it's called Mary Kay. No. Sorry, that's a really bad joke. It's Estee Lauder, actually. But actually, she had written a book about cosmetics. We have fragments of that work still available. And in that are portions about poisons. Big surprise. She knew all about how to poison people. She studied it and wrote about it. She was a very intelligent woman, very crafty woman. So they began doing a variety of experiments, and to their shock, this scientist at Montclair State University discovered, and here's the exact thing, that calcium carbonate plus vinegar's acetic acid in water produces calcium acetate, water, and carbon dioxide, for you chemistry fans in the room. a 5% solution of acetic acid, which is sold in supermarkets today. It's the vinegar that you find on the shelf at AJ's or Safeway, is well within the concentration that's produced naturally by fermentation, and if mixed with the right amount of water, it will dissolve a pearl in 10 minutes. And you can drink the vinegar. It's not going to kill you. It would be a little awful to drink, but... So next time you want to make a statement of your love for your spouse, drop something and just see what she does. So, can I have that pearl, ma'am? I love you. Wait a minute. Anyway, yeah, so it's real. Later, Caligula, when he was emperor in 37 to 41 AD, he appointed a horse to his council, which is well known, but what wasn't well known is that during the ceremony of appointing the horse to his council, he crowned the horse with a necklace of pearls to indicate how wealthy this horse was. I think our Senate's doing that. No, I'm sorry. Nero had a throne and a scepter that was so heavy with pearls, it was hard to pick up and use. It was just very ceremonial. Spanish conquistadors discovered an island in the Caribbean, first landed there by Columbus. The discovery in that island of a pearl bed became a source of 1/3 of the entire New World tribute to the Spanish crown. That island is known as the Pearl of the Caribbean. No pun intended. Yeah. Margarita Island, ever heard of it? Well, the Greek word for pearl is margaritis. Where we get our word Margaret. So anybody by the name of Margaret, your name means pearl. So when they were talking about the pearl of great price, it's actually the Margaret of great price in your New Testament. Isn't that interesting?
So they named the Pearl Island, really?
They named the island for the pearls. Yeah. And used the Greek word for it, not the Spanish word for it. All that's to say, pearls were rare. Pearls were very difficult to find, especially in this era. And if you, the reason I went through this entire litany is to look at how the kingdom itself, the secular kingdom, looked at pearls. So here he's talking to these fishermen, these generally poor, hand-to-mouth, hourly wage kind of people, you know, blue-collar workers, and he's talking about some merchant who's searching the world for the great pearl, and when he finds it, he's an emporos. He would be the owner of JCPenney, the owner of Target, would sell everything just to have that one pearl. Isn't that an incredible point? From a secular standpoint, there's a fellow by the name of Robert Thompson who owned 180 newspapers and 290 other companies. This is many years ago. And he was worth hundreds of millions of dollars at the time. He was asked, what would you give to buy the New York Times? And he said, I would mortgage my soul. In other words, I would sell all I had just to have that crown of newspapers. So how do we treat our gospel? When we search it and we find it, what would you give up if you possibly could lose that great treasure? Would you sell all you had? Would you give up everything? Family, friends, treasure, 401k accounts? I mean, would you give it all up? That's what Jesus is trying to get to these disciples saying, what I am, who I am, the kingdom of heaven is so incredibly valuable. You should give everything. And it's interesting, verse 51, if you drop down, I am skipping, says, have you understood all this? And the disciples say, yeah, we get it. How did those disciples live that challenge? They went out with the message of Christ after the resurrection. They went into every highway and byway as far as they could, and we know the story. They were all martyred. They gave everything when they found that great pearl, that great treasure. They had been searching. Some of them searching directly, some of them looking for something great, and they found it. I'm right up against my time limit here, but I want to end with two verses which kind of put a nice little end point to this. Philippians 3:8. I count everything a loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. For his sake I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish, in order that I may gain Christ. Paul believed that. He wrote it. And we quote that verse, not making the connection over here to the pearl of great price. We never think about that they are saying the same thing. I will give it all. Then over in 1 Peter 1:4, according to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you. And I want to say, a treasure beyond measure. And that is what these parables are all about. I believe, we'll end our time. Doug, you are going to introduce our special guests.